This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Jimmy Santiago Baca is a poet whose rough and tumble early life is now the backbone of his work. He was born in the Southwest, where he was abandoned by his parents as a toddler, ran away from an orphanage at the age of 13, figured out how to navigate the streets, watched drugs and violence take the lives of those around him, faced a criminal trial, went to prison, and was in solitary confinement for 3 years, where he learned to read and write. Started writing poetry, trading poems for cigarettes. Jimmy remained in jail, but his poems got out. One of the earliest publishers was the Chapel Hill magazine, The Sun. After he got out, Jimmy was invited to North Carolina by a fellow poet. Since then, he's released a number of publications and won the American Book Award for Poetry. Well, he's back in North Carolina now for a ticketed collaboration with jazz violinist Christian Howes and playwright David Gonzalez. That's in Durham on Friday at 7:30. Also going to be at the Durham Literacy Center for a ticketed reading on Saturday evening. Jimmy Santiago Baca, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So take me back to those early years in the Southwest where you were growing up.
Early years, at the age of five, they took me out of my village, a mestizo village, a Chicano village. Orphanage, I think 11, 12 years. Streets, detention center, gladiator school, county jail, prison, and here now.
Who was the they who took you out of the...
The government. The government would come in, and they needed to fill up... They had quotas. So they needed to fill the schools up in order to get that money. So they would go to the surrounding villages and pick up kids that they thought... Well, my mom and dad were gone. They abandoned me, so I was living with my grandparents. So that was a good reason to come get me and my brother and put us in an orphanage. And therein started the 25 years of being institutionalized.
Mm-hmm. So you're in, and had you learned to read and write? What was your relationship with literacy at that point?
There was not a bunch of importance put on that. Yeah. It was more behavioral and getting me inculcated into the Catholic religion.
So you go to prison. That's where I understand where you really learn to appreciate poetry?
True, especially with a gentleman from here, from Durham, Will Inman. He wrote me a letter, and therein started a correspondence that ensued for the next 15 years.
What was in that letter that got you?
He asked me. He was an amazing man. He asked me what I needed, and he sent me pencils and paper. And what he did, more importantly than anything else, was encourage me to write and tell me, you have a fabulous, fabulous gift. And then he opened up the first bilingual publication in the United States along the border in Tucson and published at least 50 of my poems in that Illuminations magazine.
Well, when did you start writing poetry?
I started when I was trying to formulate. In the prison that I was in, there was a really good chance that I wouldn't live tomorrow. And this was a reoccurring daily thing. So if I got by today, woke up this morning, there's a good chance I won't live the day out, right? Because of the guards, the warden, or the convicts. I decided to try to write my poem to my grandmother to tell her how much I loved her. That poem is called It's All I Have to Give, and it's been circulated worldwide and anthologized at least 500 times since that day I wrote it. It's all I have to give. I wanted to tell her how much I loved her, but I didn't have anything to give her except my love and my respect. And guys started reading it and coming by and saying, can I have a copy? Can I have a copy? Can I have a copy? And then they turned it into a love poem. Can I send this to my girlfriend? Can I send this to my wife? You know, I have nothing. All I have to give you is my love. And soon all the anthologies picked it up and on and on and on.
Had you been writing poetry up until that time, or this
never
was just...
picked up a book in my life? They were the enemies. They were inimical assassins to my culture, because they wrote bad things about us. So I could ask my sister during a visit, "Can you go get me a dictionary in the county jail?" Because no one ever visited me in prison, and I would tell my sister, "Can you go get me a book?" At the bookstore, and she would pinch her eyebrows and say, "Heroin?" I say, no, a book. Give me a real book. And she'd be like, "Coke or meth?" I'd be like, "No, a book." And she would say, "A shank?" I'd be like, "Tina, I want a real book." And then she would look and go back and say, Are you kidding me? I'll never go in a bookstore. I'd rather go to a dealer's house than a bookstore.
Well, talk about your background then. Which your ethnic background?
I'm a Chicano, which means Comanchero, which Comancheros, Comanche, Apache, you know, Mexican, Rarámuri, Chicano, and that's who I am.
So, in what way did you think that books, at least at that time, did you feel you and your sister, obviously, that books you said were inimical to your people?
Well, I didn't go to school at all.
Yeah,
I never went to school. I came out of the orphanage when I was about 13, I guess, and I went to junior high school one day. And I thought the math teacher, I sat in school, number one, I lived with my aunt. I went to the bus stop. I was so terrified of standing next to a girl because I had never stood next to a girl. I got in a bus, and I was terrified of being in a co-ed bus. Mm-hmm. Got into the classroom, and I thought the teacher was doing rock writing the way we do it in our pueblos, where you see these X's and these minus signs and the plus signs. Those are all on the rocks around my village. So I thought he was writing in hieroglyphics when, in fact, it was called math. It was called algebra. And I was like, I just left. I took off and never came back. So I left school. One day I went there in ninth grade and never went back.
So you are now in prison. You think, I might not make it tomorrow. The last thing I want to do at least is tell my grandmother how much I love her. What you write turns out to be a poem. And then it becomes, as you say, certainly wildly popular within the population. Later it would be anthologized. Did you then begin writing poetry after that, or was it still?
I started writing poetry because the inmates, I had killers and muggers and thieves and extortionists and burglars all trading me poems for coffee and cigarettes. And then one guy, a gangster, a true blue gangster, came by and said, hey, he threw a magazine in my cell and said, hey, why don't you send them some of your poems? So I didn't even know how to address a letter. So I had to ask a friend of mine, how do you address this envelope? He did. I sent it. I got a response back later from Mother Jones with $300, $100 per poem. And Mother Jones suddenly made me famous. Next thing I know, LSU wrote a letter. And this is funny. It's sort of ironic. They invited me to dinner because they wanted to publish a book of mine, Baton Rouge, Louisiana State University Press. And we would love to come out and take you to dinner. And I wrote him, you know what, you can publish the book, but the dinner's got to wait.
Okay. So talk about then the connection to North Carolina and how you came out here.
I was writing Virginia Love Long. She sent me an airline ticket.
And that is someone who lives in Person County or lived in Person County.
That's somebody who lives in Hurdle Mills.
Yeah.
And she had two or three books of poetry. And she was translating Mesoamerican poetry at the time. And she was a friend of Will Inman's, who was corresponding with me. And he introduced me to her. And I met Ann Evans and Carl Evans and all those people via, you know, through Virginia Love Long. First day out, I went to my brother's house who I was supposed to live with, but he committed a robbery that day. And I got really scared that I was going to go back. So I found the envelope she sent me, opened it up, the airline ticket was in there, and I got on a plane and came. She picked me up at the Durham Airport. I went out to Hurdle Mills. And it was my first full day as a free human being. And I began to think of myself possibly as having a chance in this world as a poet.
What was that like? So you went from prison to Person County, Hurdle Mills, North Carolina. What was your sense of this place? I mean, you hadn't been here before, right?
No, I hadn't, but I felt an instant visceral connection to it. It was a tribal connection. I felt instantly that this was the place I needed to be. This was mother's womb for me for the moment, and here I would be born. I swear that's what I felt. Because who came to Hurdle Mills was a convict. Who arrived in Hurdle Mills and started to live in Hurdle Mills was going through the most excruciating birth canal, if that's what you want to call it. Hurdle Mills became my birth canal, and it was excruciating for me to learn how to breathe free. For instance, it was freezing cold. And Virginia used to work for the Durham newspaper, and she left. She came back that day, that night, and it was freezing cold in the house. And she says, why didn't you just close the window? And I said, because I was taught not to. I can't get up and close the window until you tell me to do it. And then she said, oh, my God, what they conditioned you. Yes, I said, authority. You're the authority figure. I can't close that window until you tell me to. And that was the reentry that was excruciating. I had to learn from the very beginning how to feel okay in a room with a bed and get up. And it's okay to go and get a cup of coffee. It's okay to go and sit on the stoop of the porch. It's okay to just look and not do anything. Because I was constantly waiting for somebody to come up behind me and say, all right, get up. You had it. Let's go. And that voice never came. It was just constantly being on alert.
I'm talking to poet Jimmy Santiago Baca, who's going to be in collaboration with jazz violinist Christian Howes and playwright David Gonzalez in Durham on Friday, also the Durham Literacy Center for a ticketed event on Saturday evening. We've got that information at our website. I wonder if I can ask you to read some of your poetry.
Sure. Here, this is what I wrote coming out of the Durham airport going toward Bushy Forks. This is part of a novel called American Orphan that's going to be published. We pass dented roadside mailboxes and withering barns and wind-slapped houses and huge trees, warehouses, chicken farms, pig farms. I look at her breasts, her breasts, her lips, and as she drives, lust courses through every cell of my body abundantly as the kudzu overflows every inch of roadside space. The breeze dances in thick tobacco leaves, taps a Hoan slave song, and the late afternoon hums its sweet and succulent harmony and makes my mouth water. She smiles, her hand trembling as she lights another Benson and Hedges cigarette. The air, the space, the sky, all of it is a dream come true. Lila downshifts, speeds up past red brick and clapboard flour mills and brick houses set in quiet clearings. I lean my head back, glad to be free, healthy, and young. I stand up on the seat. I raise my arms to the wind the way I've seen kids do in movies and remember back in the orphanage when we went picking apples at the outlying orchard farms. And on the way back, riding in the back on top of a mountain of apples, I'd stand up and wave to cars and people and holler. And I was just full of red apple joy, as I am now. With Cat Stevens on the radio, we speed by meadows, Guernseys, grazing silos, strawberry fields, wheat and tobacco fields, and clay-packed farm roads where she brakes and accelerates up and down through the Piedmont foothills, fingers clutching the steering wheel, racing down a long road bordered on both sides with pines, feeling like the whole world is new and mine. I fell out, or almost do, when she makes a sharp turn at a grocery store called Green Mill, and as I sit, we race down a blacktop bordered with dormant red clay fields in the shade of plank barns warped from having been too long in the hot and cold seasons. Barn dogs snooze and scratch ears and harness scarred mules mosey one step at a time and stop. Then after a bit, step again. Finally, we slow turn into a fenceless yard where a small red brick house sits with a pump house next to it, and she parks and turns off the ignition.
That's an excerpt from the forthcoming publication, American Orphan, by poet and writer Jimmy Santiago Baca. You can see Jimmy in collaboration with jazz violinist Christian Howes at a ticketed event. Also going to be there with playwright David Gonzalez. That event is in Durham on Friday at 7:30. There's also a ticketed fundraiser for the Durham Literacy Center on Saturday at 7 o'clock. And, of course, we've got the information at our website, stateofthings.org. So that was how long ago when that happened? 40 years ago. Now you just came. Have you been back since?
This is my 40-year anniversary. I've never been back. I closed the circle, and I came back to see Ann Evans and Carl. And I got to tell you, man, it's been one of the most spiritual, scintillating closing of circles. It's been a spiritual engagement with the highest order of cosmic powers that I've ever could imagine. I mean, this is very, very few people get this opportunity to come back and close the circle.
What was it like? What was the feeling? What went through your body?
Oh my God! It was I was anxious when I got off the plane. My wife was worried about me because she says you're not sleeping at all week before I came. And instantly when I got in the car with Carl, and then instantly when I got to Ann's house, I was like, I just felt like a child again. That was basking in someone's love and someone's acceptance and someone's non-judgmental friendship. And I felt human, just like I did back then after 25 years of being institutionalized and treated with screams and yells and kicks and really abusive neglect. I came out, and that day I came out here 40 years ago, they accepted me in their house. This time when I walked into their house, it was the same feeling of being human again. And I closed my eyes and thanked God and said, Lord, thank you so much for allowing me to close the circle, because not only convicts never get this opportunity. Yeah. People rarely get to go all the way back around And when you look at your past in that sense, you have to ask yourself, what does it mean? What does it mean that I was able to close this circle? What does it mean that I went out as an addict and an alcoholic and I was in the crime and stuff and I didn't die, that I came back? What does it mean? And a voice said to me, it's a good thing because you didn't harm anybody. And I'll take that measurement any day of the week.
You talked about a circle, but I can imagine a spiral as well. That you didn't just spin around. I mean, you began creating poetry then outside of the institutional environment. How was that for you? What was the trajectory from that moment when you got here to the 40-year career you've had since in writing and poetry? Obviously, you were writing in prison. How was it different?
Wow. It was this constant journey of facing my fear. I mean, I've done feature films. I've done internationally famous cult films that are still out there with 200 million people following it still. I've done almost 30 books in 29 languages, all of them in print. How do I look at that? I don't know how I can look at that except to be thankful for the beginning of that journey. That's what I'm so grateful for, is the beginning of that journey, never knowing I was able to write a book and then writing one and finishing another one and writing another one, then going to Hollywood and writing movies. It was just touch and go and falling down a lot, but never on two knees, always one knee. Yeah. When I fell on one knee, and I was always able to get up for the next round.
It does seem like two dramatically different lives. Famously, people say, you know, write what you know. But we're imagining a fairly gentle trajectory in the acquisition of knowledge and the acquisition of experience in a life experience. These are so radically different, it seems to me, or were they, that I wonder what sort of admixture of the before and after, you know, your work takes on, or where you go when you write, if you go all the way back, or if you're looking at how things improved and the sense of being loved outside the institution.
I started writing poetry in prison, and it saved me then. And the only thing that kept me together and out here, because I didn't know how to define freedom, I didn't know what it was for, I don't know how you do it, I don't know what you do with it. I had to turn to poetry out here real hard, because no matter how the appearance of that looks, I held the Wallace Stevens Chair at Yale, the Berkeley Regents Chair, they have all my archives at Stanford. No matter how all that looks, there were nights of endless drug abuse where I screamed in the dark. There was drunken nights. There was horrible, horrible nights where I felt I would never, ever, ever be able to make the next dawn. And so behind that facade of all those awards and prestigious accolades and commendations, behind that is a man just struggling day to day to keep going forward in recovery.
And you shouldn't surprise anyone that you do a lot of counseling and literacy and work in trying to bring people along in literacy. Talk about your work.
Yeah. We have had a program for 30 years, an internship program where we send out kids to help teachers teach creative writing programs. We have a book program. We have a bookmobile that we go out and give tacos and books. For every book you get two tacos. We have a needle program where we go out and send batteries of interns from AmeriCorps and just from all over the world they come. And they go out and pick needles off the parks and sidewalks that junkies throw so kids and dogs won't get stuck. We have literacy programs. We send them to help the teachers teach. We have library programs. We have a book program. And it just goes on. We have a convict program where the convicts come to my house and they all sit around a table and we all talk about the problems that we're having. I've been free now for 30 years or so. And I'm still struggling with reentry. So I have to give all that back out. And it wasn't a practical judgment that I made. It was just some impulsive intuition that led me to where I am today. And that meant leaving Hollywood. That meant leaving Literati in New York. That meant just doing what I do. And I can't believe that my life has been so fulfilled. Between the sorrow and the joy came fulfillment.
Jimmy Santiago Baca. You can see him Friday at 7:30 in collaboration with jazz violinist Christian Howes and playwright David Gonzalez. That event is a ticketed event at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship, the Eno River, and also going to be at the Durham Literacy Center Saturday at 7 o'clock at the Jewish Community Center in Durham. And of course, we've got all the information at our website, stateofthings.org. Jimmy, what a pleasure. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Just ahead, the Durham Symphony Orchestra celebrates the music of Florence Price, the first African-American composer to have her work performed by a major symphony orchestra. Stay with us.